to dealer showrooms in the summer of 1990, 9 years after the GM10 program began. Meanwhile, Ford had launched its Taurus and Sable models as expected at the end of 1985, and Honda had gone through two generations of its Accord model, moving it up in size almost to match the physical dimensions of the GM10 cars. Not surprisingly, the GM10s, although generally agreed to be competent, have encountered rough competition in the market. By 1986, GM had decided that the 1.6 million unit annual production goal for the existing A and G bodies was not realistic, and had scaled back production plans for the GM10s to 1 million units annually, and from 7 final assembly plants to 4. The company wanted to reach this goal by 1990. In fact, 1989 sales were only at about 60% of the planned level, meaning that even with continuing sales of some A-bodies, GM lost 700,000 units of sales in its largest selling segment during the 1980s. What's more, as we saw in the last chapter, the GM10 cars are neither easy nor inexpensive to make. Thus, what was formerly one of GM's most profitable areas, the intermediate segment, no longer pulls its weight. Indeed, the A-bodies that GM10 was to replace have proved much more profitable in the late 1980s, and the company now plans to continue the production of the Oldsmobile and Buick variants indefinitely. The Honda Accord, Lean Product Development. At the beginning of 1986, when the GM10 program was already 4 years along, Honda began planning its own product for the intermediate segment, the fourth generation Accord, to be launched in the fall of 1989 as a 1990 model. Since its introduction in 1976, the Accord had been the key to Honda's success in export markets, and had grown steadily from subcompact to intermediate size to reflect the increasing incomes and family size of its loyal buyers. Honda's product development process is quite different from GM's. In 1985, Tateomi Miyoshi was appointed Large Project Leader, LPL, for the new Accord, and given powers far surpassing any Robert Dorn ever dreamed of. While Honda also uses a matrix, in which each product member is on loan from a functional department, Miyoshi was told to borrow appropriate people from each of the relevant departments and transfer them to the Accord project for its life. Rather than coordinating, Miyoshi's task was, clearly, to manage. He could move the project along rapidly, because all the necessary resources were under his direct control. As the Accord plan was finalized, it became clear that the car would serve different market demands in different parts of the world. For the U.S. market, both a two-door coupe and a station wagon would be important, as would a four-door sedan. For the Japanese market, a four-door hardtop would be needed along with a sedan and the coupe, the latter to be imported from the United States. Finally, Europe would be served by the sedan from Japan and the coupe and station wagon from the United States. In addition, Honda needed slightly different versions of each car for its separate Honda and Vigor distribution channels in Japan. Honda therefore decided to subdivide its development work into one Japanese team responsible for the basic car, including the four-door sedan, and two sub-teams, one in the United States responsible for the coupe and station wagon variants, and one in Japan responsible for the four-door hardtop. The coupe and station wagon were to be produced exclusively in the United States at Honda's Marysville, Ohio complex, using production tools designed and built at Marysville, while the sedan was to be built in both Japan and the United States, and the hardtop in Japan only. Once the product plan was set, the Honda team steamed ahead at breakneck speed and with no interruptions. While team members continued to work closely with their functional departments for the reasons we just mentioned, Miyoshi and practically every member of the team continued in their jobs until well after the new model was launched on schedule in the fall of 1989. They then returned to their functional departments or were assigned to a new product development project perhaps the Next Generation Accord, set for introduction in the fall of 1993. While a conservative design, the Accord has been a resounding success in the marketplace, particularly in North America. In fact, since 1989, it has been the largest selling model in North America, a position always held during the previous 80 years by a GM or Ford product. A snapshot of product development around the world. The GM10 and Accord cases suggest a striking difference between the lean and mass production approaches to product development and the consequences for competitive success. But they are only two examples, and it would be dangerous to draw firm conclusions on such limited, if provocative, evidence. Fortunately, just as we were launching our research in 1986, Professor Kim Clark at the Harvard Business School was undertaking a worldwide survey of product development activities in the motor industry. With the help of Takahiro Fujimoto, a PhD candidate at the business school, Clark surveyed practically every auto assembler in North America, Japan, and Western Europe. He asked how many hours of engineering effort were needed and how much time it had taken to produce their most recent new products. Though our projects were entirely separate in inspiration, funding, and conduct, we benefited from lengthy discussions with the Clark team, and their work complements our global surveys of factory practice and supply system management. Clark and his team initially faced the same problem as we did in the assembly plant. How do you ensure an apples-to-apples comparison? Automobile development projects can vary greatly in the size and complexity of the vehicles, the number of different body styles spun off a base model, or platform, in car talk, the number of carryover parts from previous models, and the number of shared parts from other models in a producer's range. As we have noted, carryover and shared parts require much less engineering than totally new parts. Since they are already developed, they often need only minor modifications to fit into a new model. After they made adjustments for these variables, the Clark team's findings were simple and striking. Based on 29 clean sheet development projects reaching the market between 1983 and 1987, Clark found that a totally new Japanese car required 1.7 million hours of engineering effort on average and took 46 months from first design to customer deliveries. By clean sheet, we simply mean that these were cars with totally new bodies, although some used carryover or shared engines. By contrast, the average U.S. and European projects of comparable complexity, and with the same fraction of carryover and shared parts, took 3 million engineering hours and consumed 60 months. This, then, is the true magnitude of the performance difference between lean and mass production. Nearly a 2-to-1 difference in engineering effort, and a saving of 1/3 in development time. Perhaps the most remarkable feature of Clark's survey is his finding that lean product development techniques simultaneously reduce the effort and time involved in manufacturing. This fact turns on its head one of the most common assumptions, one that is based on 70 years' experience with mass production, namely, that any project can be speeded up in a crisis, but that doing so greatly increases the cost and amount of effort. We're all familiar with the refrain, "Sure, I can get it ready sooner, but it's going to cost you a fortune." We suggest that "faster is dearer" will now join "quality costs more," an idea debunked in Chapter 4 on the junk heap of ideas left over from the age of mass production. The techniques of lean design. It's wonderful to know that new products can now be produced faster with less effort and fewer errors. However, as we've noted, innovations are most useful when they are available to everyone, and as we have seen, practices at General Motors and the other mass producers lag far behind. What then are the precise techniques of lean design that the best auto firms use? And how can they be transferred to existing mass producers? To find the answer, we began by looking at Clark's and Fujimoto's work, but then asked Anthony Sheriff and Kentaro Nobeoka of our IMVP staff to conduct additional investigations. Sheriff, a former product planner with Chrysler, had become disillusioned with American approaches to product development when he joined the IMVP, while Nobeoka was a product planner on leave from Mazda to pursue a PhD at MIT. Between the two of them, they had a vast knowledge of product development as it looks from the inside. From Clark's and Fujimoto's work and our own investigations, we conclude that there are four basic differences in design methods employed by mass and lean producers. These are differences in leadership, teamwork, communication, and simultaneous development. Taken together, lean techniques in these four areas make it possible to do a better job faster with less effort. Leadership. First, let's look at the leadership of a project. The lean producers invariably employ some variant of the Shusa system pioneered by Toyota, termed the Large Project Leader or LPL system at Honda. The Shusa is simply the boss, the leader of the team, whose job it is to design and engineer a new product and get it fully into production. In the best Japanese companies, the position of Shusa carries great power and is perhaps the most coveted in the company. True, employees may seek the position as a stepping stone to the top. However, for those who truly love to make things, the job brings extraordinary satisfaction. In fact, it's the best position in the modern world from which to orchestrate all the skills needed to make a wonderfully complex manufactured product, such as the automobile, come into being. One might even say that the Shusa is the new super craftsman, directing a process that now requires far too many skills for any one person to master. Oddly, while we're used to thinking of dedicated teamwork as the ultimate sublimation of individuality, new products inside the Japanese auto industry are commonly known by the Shusa's name. That is Fuji-san's car, or Akoika-san has really stamped his personality on that car, are phrases commonly heard within Japanese companies. Perhaps, after all, we cannot escape a human need for craftsmen to exist. However, in an era when the skills involved are not so much technical as social and organizational, and far beyond the grasp of any individual, craftsmen must now take the form of the Shusa. Western mass producers also have development team leaders, as we saw in the GM10 example. What's the difference between the two systems? We believe it lies in the power and career path of the team leader. In Western teams, the leader is more properly called a coordinator, whose job it is to convince team members to cooperate. It's a frustrating role, because the leader really has limited authority, so few team leaders report enjoying it. Indeed, many company executives view the job as a dead end, in which success leads to little reward and failure is highly visible, as we saw in the story about the GM10 project, which opens this chapter. What's more, the team leader is in an extremely weak position to champion a project within the company. It's common in Detroit, Wolfsburg, and Paris for top management to override the team leader about the specifications and feel of the product, often repeatedly during the course of development. That this happens is understandable, given senior management's role in juggling other corporate needs as market conditions change. However, in the worst case, and all too frequently, particularly in the United States, the result is a product with no personality or distinction that the company must sell solely on the basis of low price. Teamwork. The problem here becomes clearer by looking at the second element of lean design, the tightly knit team. As we saw, in the lean development process, the Shusa assembles a small team which is then assigned to a development project for its life. These employees come from functional departments of the company: market assessment, product planning, styling, advanced engineering, detail engineering, body, engine, transmission, electrical, production engineering, and factory operations. they retain ties to their functional department. It's vital that they do so, as we explained earlier in this chapter. But for the life of the program, they are clearly under the control of the Shusa. How they perform in the team, as judged by the Shusa, will control their next assignment, which will probably be another development team. In contrast, in most Western companies, a development project consists of individuals, including the team leader, who are on short-term loan from a functional department. Moreover, the project itself is moved from department to department along a sort of production line, which leads from one end of the company to the other. That is, the project is actually picked up and moved from the marketing department to the engineering divisions, and then to the factory operations department during its life, in the same way that a car moves from the welding to the painting to the assembly department in the assembly plant. So it is worked on by totally different people in each area. The members of the team know that their career success depends on moving up through their functional specialty, getting promoted from chief piston engineer to deputy chief engine engineer to chief engine engineer, for example, and they work very hard in the team to advance the interest of their department. In other words, being a member of the GM10 team, say, doesn't lead anywhere. The team leader will never see an employee's personnel records, and the leader's performance evaluation won't make much difference to the employee's career. Key evaluations will come from the head of the employee's functional division, who wants to know, "What did you do for my department?" As a result, discussing the best way to achieve harmony between the engine and the body, for example, really can disintegrate into a politicized debate between the interests of the engine engineering department and the body engineering department. The continuity in the Japanese development teams is reflected in another of Clark's and Fujimoto's findings. They discovered that about 900 engineers are involved in a typical project in an American or European company over its life, while a typical Japanese team enlists only about 485. What was more, those Japanese firms most committed to the Shusa system, which Clark and Fujimoto term heavyweight team management, needed an average of only 333 team members, while the Western firms with the weakest teams, mostly in Germany, needed an average of 1,421 staff members during the life of a project. The Japanese use fewer people, partly because efficient organization requires fewer bodies, but also because there is so little turnover in the Japanese teams. Because Western department managers view team members as simply the representatives of their home department in the development process, they show little concern about frequently recalling staff as other needs for their skills crop up in their own department. For the team, however, these recalls mean a great loss, because much of the essential knowledge of a development team lies in the shared viewpoints and experiences of team members over an extended period. Communication. This point brings us to the third feature of lean design, communication. Clark and Fujimoto found that many Western development efforts fail to resolve critical design trade-offs until very late in the project. One reason is that U.S. team members show great reluctance to confront conflicts directly. They make vague commitments to a set of design decisions, agreeing, that is, to try to do something as long as no reason crops up not to. In Japan, by contrast, team members sign formal pledges to do exactly what everyone has agreed upon as a group. So conflicts about resources and priorities occur at the beginning rather than at the end of the process. Another reason is that a design process that is sequential, going from one department to the next rather than being kept at team headquarters, makes communication to solve problems very difficult in any case. The result is a striking difference in the timing of the effort devoted to a project. In the best Japanese lean projects, the numbers of people involved are highest at the very outset. All the relevant specialties are present, and the Shusa's job is to force the group to confront all the difficult trade-offs they'll have to make to agree on the project. As development proceeds, the number of people involved drops, as some specialties, such as market assessment and product planning, are no longer needed. By contrast, in many mass production design exercises, the number of people involved is very small at the outset, but grows to a peak very close to the time of launch, as hundreds or even thousands of extra bodies are brought in to resolve problems that should have been cleared up in the beginning. The process is very similar to what we saw in the assembly plant. The mass producer keeps the line moving at all costs, but ends up doing massive amounts of rework at the end, while the lean producer spends more effort up front correcting problems before they multiply, and ends up with much less total effort and higher quality in the end. Simultaneous development. The final technique separating lean from mass production in product development is simultaneous development. To see what we mean by this term, let's take the example of die development. As we pointed out in Chapter 4, practically every car and light truck built in the world today has a body constructed of stamped steel panels. The heavy metal forms, called dies, needed to press finished body panels out of sheet steel, are among the most complex and expensive tools in the industrial world. They are made of exotic steel alloys for extreme strength and hardness, and must be formed to tolerances of microns across continuously curved surfaces. What's more, the matching faces of the die, the upper and lower or male and female elements, must mesh with absolute precision. Otherwise, the sheet steel will tear or even melt to the face of the dies as the two pieces come together under tons of pressure. The mass production approach to die making has been simple. Wait until the product designers give precise specifications for the stamped part. Then order an appropriate block of steel in the die production department and cut it using expensive, computer-driven die-cutting machines. Because cutting proceeds through many steps involving many machines, this process means that the dies pile up waiting for the next machine to become available. Total development time, from the first day that product designers order a new set of dies until the dies begin stamping panels for production cars, is about 2 years. By contrast, the best lean producers, and they're all Japanese, but no longer only in Japan. Honda is designing and cutting dies for its Marysville, Ohio plant at Marysville, begin die production at the same time they start body design. How can they? Because the die designers and the body designers are in direct, face-to-face contact and probably have worked together in previous product development teams. The die designers know the approximate size of the new car and the approximate number of panels, so they go ahead and order blocks of die steel. Then they begin to make rough cuts in the steel, so it's ready to move to final cutting as soon as the final panel designs are released. This process, of course, involves a considerable degree of anticipation. The die designer must understand the panel design process as well as the panel designer does, and be able to anticipate accurately the panel designer's final solution. When the die designer is correct, development time is drastically shortened. When the die designer is wrong, and infrequent occurrence, the company pays a cost penalty. Still, the original schedule can be met by giving the catch-up die priority routing through the cutting process. Also, the lean die makers seem to be much better at scheduling production in the die-cutting shop. Their solution should come as no surprise if you remember the example of Ono's stamping shop from Chapter 3. The die-cutters have special, quick-change cutting tools, allowing one machine to handle many different types of cuts. So the dies that are being cut spend much less time in queues. What's the end result of this intense communication between panel designers and die makers, plus accurate anticipation by the die makers and clever scheduling of flexible cutting machines? It means that the best lean producers in Japan and in Ohio, can produce a complete set of production-ready dies for a new car in only 1 year, exactly half the time needed in typical mass-production die making. Not surprisingly, this process requires fewer tools, lower inventories, since the key element, the expensive die steel, is in the shop only half as long, and less human effort. Production Development Box Score, Lean versus Mass. We summed up all the advantages of lean product development in the form of a box score. When we review this box score, we can see several additional advantages of lean design. For one, lean design results in a much higher fraction of projects coming into production on time. Indeed, 5 of 6 Japanese projects reach the market on the timetable laid out at the beginning of development, while only half of American projects come in on time. The GM10 project was worse than average in its slippage, but hardly unusual. Another advantage lies in the ability of the lean factory to absorb new products without paying a productivity penalty. Many Western analysts have been badly misled by the slow startup schedules, ramp-up rates in car talk of the Japanese transplants in North America and Europe. What they fail to realize is that these facilities are building up the social process of production step by step, and this takes time. For example, Toyota executives at the Georgetown, Kentucky plant say that it will take a decade for the plant to fully master the Toyota production system. To ensure that no one takes shortcuts, they've built up the plant's production rate very slowly, stopping as necessary to get each step right rather than rushing ahead and going back later to rework errors not just in the cars but in the entire production organization. However, once lean production is fully in place in the factory, it's easy to introduce new products developed by a lean development process. For example, Japanese plants taking on new models regain their previous productivity level in 4 months, while the Americans need 5, and the Europeans need an entire year. Much more striking is the difference in quality. Japanese lean production plants can introduce new lean designs with only a small blip in delivered quality, while American and European plants struggle for a year to get quality back to its original level, which is lower than that of the Japanese to begin with. The consequences of lean design in the marketplace. What do companies that have mastered lean design do to take advantage of their strength in the marketplace? Obviously, they will offer a wider variety of products and replace them more frequently than mass production competitors. And this is exactly what has been happening in the auto industry across the world in the 1980s. In our study, we summarized the number of models the Japanese car companies were selling worldwide between 1982 and 1990. We then compare this number with the total worldwide product offerings by the U.S.-headquartered producers and the 5 high-volume European car companies, PSA, Renault, Fiat, Rover, and Volkswagen. We provide a separate calculation for 5 smaller European specialist firms, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, and Jaguar. The trend is striking. The Japanese firms are using their advantage in lean production to expand their product range rapidly, even as they renew existing products every 4 years. Between 1982 and 1990, they nearly doubled their product portfolio from 47 to 84 models. At the same time, the European volume firms were pursuing old-fashioned mass production strategies as they struggled to absorb the companies taken over in the 1970s and 1980s. They reduced their models on offer slightly, from 49 to 43, and allowed remaining models to age markedly. Specifically, PSA, Peugeot, rationalized the product offerings of Citroën and Chrysler Europe, while Fiat consolidated the offerings of Alfa Romeo. Recently, Volkswagen has absorbed the Spanish producer Seat, which previously built Fiat designs under license. Volvo and Renault have agreed to collaborate on automaking activities, and General Motors has become the senior partner in a joint venture involving Saab's automotive operations. These events suggest that one more round of product rationalization may be carried through in Europe in the early 1990s. The Americans, by contrast, have managed a substantial increase in their product ranges from 36 to 53 models, but at a cost, as you can see by looking at the average number of years the average product has been in production. In the case of the Japanese producers, this number is between 1.5 and 2.0 years, about what one would expect from companies with policies of replacing every model every 4 years. For the Americans, by contrast, the average age has risen from 2.7 to 4.7 years, suggesting that the average model is now kept in production for nearly 10 years rather than the 8 years common in the past. The reason, we believe, is simply that the Americans, with their inefficient product development processes, are finding they do not have the money or engineers to expand their product range and renew their products frequently. A quick look at the North American motor vehicle market indicates that the Japanese strategy of the 1980s is likely to continue in the 1990s. As of the 1991 model year, the Japanese companies still offer no products in the full-size car, van, and pickup truck classes. Similarly, their range of offerings in the European luxury and sport specialty classes is still very modest, despite the recent excitement about Lexus, Infiniti, and Acura. Large cars and pickup trucks are the most profitable areas of the entire world market, so it would be remarkable if the Japanese producers did not move ahead rapidly to complete their product offerings in the larger size classes of cars, trucks, and vans, and perhaps to develop new market segments as well. At the same time, the European volume producers will soon complete their product consolidation process, and companies from all three regions are likely to be adding products such as mini minivans in the smaller size classes. The consequence? All surviving producers will offer a wider product range in the 1990s. But unless the Western mass producers transform their product development systems, the Japanese producers will be able to widen their range much more rapidly, and even as they do so, be able to keep their existing products fresh by replacing them every 4 years. This trend has striking implications for production volumes, both annually for each model and cumulatively over each model's life. If we look at the average annual production volume for all models produced worldwide by the companies headquartered in each region, American volume per model has been falling, not only because the number of models offered has increased, but because the Americans as a group have been losing market share and total volume. Nevertheless, the Americans still produce 60% more units of their average model each year than do the Japanese. European production per model among the volume producers has also been rising, partly due to model consolidation and partly due to the extremely strong European car market. The Europeans are currently also producing 60% more copies of the average model each year than the Japanese. We take the analysis one step further. By doubling average product age, then multiplying by average annual production volume per model, for the Americans, the European volume producers, the European specialists, and the Japanese. Because the Japanese models, with very few exceptions, remain in production only 4 years, compared with 8 to 10 years for the American and European volume producers, it is not surprising that the Japanese are producing only one quarter as many copies of each car during its production life. What is surprising is that the very long model lives of the European specialist products result in 50% more copies being produced during their lives than of the average Japanese mass-market car. Who are the real specialists in today's world auto industry? A final perspective on lean product strategy emerges when we shift our focus from production volumes worldwide to what has been happening in a specific market, notably the U.S. car, van, and truck market. A broad array of market segments are now served with a surprisingly even level of sales across segments. Our studies show the dramatic increase in the number of products on offer since the heyday of mass production in 1955 and the continually declining number of sales per product. In fact, the ultimate destination of lean production in terms of the variety of product offerings is unknown. We have recently talked with Japanese auto executives planning continuing and major reductions in their target volume for sales of each product. In the extreme case, although not for several decades, is it possible that we will return full circle to the world of craft production, where each buyer was able to custom order a vehicle suited to his or her precise needs? At the beginning of the automotive age, there was an extraordinary range of products for sale, with production and sales volume for the average car very low. Often, as we saw at Panhard et Levasseur, each car was a one-of-a-kind, custom-built to the wishes of its owner. Under Henry Ford, the volume per car zoomed to 2 million copies per year for the Model T. Yet the exit of practically all craft producers from the industry meant that product variety fell from thousands to dozens of offerings. Classic mass production under Alfred Sloan increased product variety modestly, but the world awaited the arrival of lean production for a true renaissance in consumer choice, and the end is not yet in sight. Where lean design goes next. When we present these findings to Western car companies, senior executives often say that the Japanese focus on short model cycles and wider product variety is interesting, but only as a curiosity, not a threat. They will never be able to sustain this pace, and consumers will soon grow tired of short cycles and too many choices, said one senior European executive, a position that ignores the success of Japanese firms using similar strategies of product proliferation with a host of other consumer products, motorcycles, cameras, watches, consumer electronics. The arrival on the scene of Japanese luxury cars seems even to have strengthened this position. As another executive remarked, buyers of luxury cars don't want constant model changes since it undermines the resale value. The Japanese will have to stop this. We respectfully disagree. We think of lean product development as a multifaceted capability, which has fundamentally changed the logic of competition in this industry. The producers in full command of these techniques can use the same development budget to offer a wider range of products or shorter model cycles, or they can spend the money they save by implementing an efficient development process for developing new technologies. If luxury car buyers resist a short model cycle, the lean producer can concentrate on a wider variety of models. If wider model variety doesn't attract customers, new technologies may. Perhaps electronic suspension, a body so immune to rust that it carries a lifetime guarantee, or even a new type of engine. And in every case, the shorter development cycle will make lean companies more responsive to sudden changes in consumer demand. The choice and the advantage will always lie with the lean producer. This becomes more apparent when we contrast lean and mass production approaches to the development of new technologies. Inventing something new. The people involved in the product development efforts we've just looked at were engaged in routine problem-solving. They combined existing components and proven engineering principles to develop new products that were up-to-date and in tune with current consumer desires. In other words, they solved problems without having to engineer anything that was fundamentally new. But what happens when the old solutions no longer work? When the external world changes in such a way that existing components and design principles are no longer adequate to do the job? And what does a company do when competition stiffens and it needs something better than a Me Too solution to maintain its market position. This is the job for research as opposed to development, the conscious process of inventing, perfecting, and introducing something that is new. As we will see, lean producers approach the problem in a very different way from mass producers. Invention in mass production. Alfred Sloan was an MIT-trained electrical engineer, so his advice on technological innovation may surprise us. In his memoirs, My Years with General Motors, he had this to say on the topic. It was not necessary to lead in technical design or run the risk of untried experiments, provided that our cars were at least equal in design to the best of our competitors in a grade. When he wrote these words in retirement in the early 1960s, Sloan had come to perceive a special problem with innovation because of the size and market dominance of GM. By that time, when GM had sewn up half the North American auto market, any truly epical innovation, say, a turbine-powered truck or a car with a plastic body, could have bankrupted Ford and Chrysler. The automaker's plight would certainly have attracted the attention of a U.S. government intent on preventing a monopoly in its largest industry. So caution made sense. GM hardly wanted to innovate its way to corporate dismemberment. However, the way GM and the other large mass producers, including those in Europe, went about organizing their fundamental research made it highly unlikely that they would come up with startling innovations in any case. Unfortunately, they have learned this sad fact only very recently. In thinking about innovation, Sloan carried Henry Ford's ideas on the division of labor to their logical extreme. He decided to concentrate the scientists and engineers who were working on advanced pre-production ideas at GM's technical center outside Detroit. There, he felt, they would be free of the daily distractions of commerce and able to focus on the company's long-term needs. Over the decades, GM built an enormous, very high-quality staff and made a number of fundamental discoveries. In the mid-1970s, in fact, GM's technological resources proved vital to the welfare of the entire world auto industry when its scientists and engineers, on very short notice, perfected the exhaust catalyst technology now used by every car company in the world to produce automobiles that meet emission standards. GM proved that when the external environment demanded quick action, it could and can innovate. Unfortunately, in the absence of a crisis, a situation in which the future of the company was at stake and normal organizational barriers to the flow of information were suspended, new ideas percolated from the research center to the market very slowly. And when a crisis did occur, the lack of day-to-day contact between the thinkers in the research center and the implementers in product development often meant embarrassing gaffes. In GM's case, these included the Corvair project in the late 1950s, the Vega project in the late 1960s, the X-Car project in the late 1970s, and the high-tech factories for the GM 10 products in the late 1980s. In each case, innovative ideas for new products and factories foundered when implementation could not live up to the original technical targets. These results are in startling contrast with what has happened in the last decade in the lean production companies. Invention in lean production. University-trained mechanical, electrical, and materials engineers start their careers in an interesting way at many of the Japanese lean producers. They assemble cars. At Honda, for example, all entry-level engineers spend their first 3 months in the company working on the assembly line. They're then rotated to the marketing department for the next 3 months. They spend the next year rotating through the engineering departments, drivetrain, body, chassis, and process machinery. Finally, after they have been exposed to the entire range of activities involved in designing and making a car, they are ready for an assignment to an engineering specialty, perhaps in the engine department. At first, they are likely to be assigned to a new product development team. but they will do very routine work, largely adapting established designs to the precise needs of the new model. This task, as we saw in the preceding chapter, continues for up to 4 years. After successfully working on a new development project, the young engineer is likely to be transferred back to the engine department to do more fundamental work, perhaps on the design of a new engine, such as the V6 and V8 units recently introduced by the Japanese producers and intended for use in a whole range of new models. An engine development program, like a new model development program, requires 3 to 4 years between initial concept and actual production. Once the engineers successfully finish their stints on this second type of development team, some of the most promising are selected for additional academic training, and then are set to work on longer-term and more advanced projects. For example, the engineer might study how to incorporate fiber reinforcements into highly stressed metal parts, such as the rods connecting the crankshaft to the pistons. In working on these projects, the engineers consult closely with academic experts on retainer to the company. However, even these longer-term development projects have a very specific objective: to remedy some weakness in the company's products identified by the product or major component development teams, so they are tied tightly to the needs and timetable of specific development projects. And the work is conducted by engineers who thoroughly understand the practicalities of product development and production. To make sure that the engineers maintain their sensitivity, Honda, for example, assigns even its most advanced engineers to spend a month of each year working in one of the other functional areas of the company: the selling divisions, factory operations, supply coordination, and so forth. The Japanese lean producers exercise extreme care not to isolate their advanced technologies from the day-to-day workings of the company and the incessant demands of the market. Based on their observations of U.S. and European mass producers, they long ago concluded that, to be effective, engineering, even of the most advanced sort, must be tied into the key market-driven activities of the company. Lean innovation in practice. Low-tech weaklings to high-tech wonders. Just how this process can work is nicely illustrated by the evolution of Japanese engine designs during the 1980s. At the beginning of the decade, the Japanese companies faced a common problem. They had assumed that energy prices would continue to climb and that consumers would want smaller cars, so they had invested billions of dollars in the late 1970s in new engine plants for small four-cylinder engines. Instead, fuel prices fell and consumers were looking for larger cars with more power. What to do? Engine sizes can be increased slightly using existing production tools by widening the bore of the cylinders and increasing their stroke. However, to go further, by adding cylinders or changing the engine's configuration from, say, 4 cylinders in a line to 6 in a V arrangement would be staggeringly expensive, because it would require junking most of the existing production tools. New billion-dollar engine plants would, in turn, drain resources from the product development teams straining to rapidly increase the range of Japanese products. Surely, the lean producers thought, there is a quicker and easier solution. In fact, there was. The product development teams turned to the advanced engineering groups, which suggested introducing every available technical feature to boost the performance of the basic 4-cylinder engines. These features were conceptually simple: fuel injection rather than carburetors, 4 valves per cylinder rather than 2, to get more fuel in and more exhaust out on each stroke, balance shafts in the bottom of the engine to damp the inherent roughness of 4-cylinder designs, turbochargers and superchargers to get more power from the same size engine, a second set of overhead cams to make valve timing more precise, and even an additional set of cams for use at higher engine speeds to get full power from the engine across a wide range of operating conditions. In addition, the engineers worked very hard on what is known in the industry as refinement, paying attention to the smallest details of an engine design so that the finished engine runs smoothly and without complaint at all speeds and in all driving conditions, imitating the performance of a much larger engine. Finally, the engineers paid endless attention to manufacturability. Because they were going against one good engineering practice, by adding parts and complexity to an already complex device, they had to work extra hard at manufacturability, so the complex engines would work properly every time and entail only the minimum of extra production expense. As these features were added during the decade of the 1980s, they had an interesting effect on public perceptions, one that was perhaps unanticipated. Even as they raised the power of the same basic engine, in some cases by a factor of two, these innovations convinced buyers, particularly in North America, that Japanese cars were now high-tech, that they now had the most advanced features. They had grown from low-tech weaklings in 1980 to high-tech wonders by 1990, while preserving their manufacturer's basic investment in production facilities for small engines. This perception on the part of consumers was enormously frustrating to engineers in many of the mass production companies who knew that all these innovations had been around the motor industry for decades. For example, four valves per cylinder and double overhead camshafts were available on the 1924 Bentley, and superchargers were common on the largest European luxury cars in the 1930s. However, they had often been vetoed by management as too expensive or complex for production use, or restricted to use in a limited range of specialty models. What's more, when the mass producers, particularly in the United States, tried to copy these innovations on a wide scale, the weaknesses of their engineering systems were exposed. In many cases, it took years to introduce a comparable feature, and often it was accompanied by drivability problems or high production costs. GM, for example, lagged Toyota by 4 years in introducing many of the features we just listed in its Quad 4 engine. It needed 2 more years to reach a high level of refinement. Even then, manufacturing bottlenecks meant that this engine was available only in a narrow range of GM cars using four-cylinder engines. Lean production versus mass in research and development. Some numerical comparisons. Given the contrasting approaches to innovation, it's not surprising that the examples we cited are typical, and that performance in the development of new technologies differs systematically. In particular, it is not surprising that the U.S. companies manage to spend more on their research activities, but badly trail the Japanese companies in a key indicator of technical strength, patenting. Our patent data are for all patents registered in the United States by motor vehicle and supplier firms from the different regions of the world. What's more, in the last decade, the Japanese lean producers have consistently outpaced the Americans and even the Europeans in bringing these patented innovations to market. A need for epical innovations? So far, we've talked about innovations that involve the introduction in production vehicles of ideas already fairly well understood on the technical level. We've listed a number of advances of this type in the 1980s. And many more will be available in the 1990s. In particular, the application of electronics to mechanical vehicle systems such as vehicle suspension, and the availability of mobile communications at lower cost in a much wider variety of vehicles. But what about epical innovations? Really big leaps in technological know-how, such as would be entailed in workable fuel cell power units, or all-plastic body structures, or sophisticated navigation and congestion avoidance systems. As we will see, the 1990s may prove a time for such innovations. Can lean producers respond to these much more daunting challenges? In fact, the world auto industry has lived during its first century in a benign environment. Demand for its products has increased continually, even in the most developed countries. Space has been available in most areas to expand road networks greatly, and the Earth's atmosphere has been able to tolerate ever-growing use of motor vehicles with minor technical fixes in the 1970s and 1980s designed to solve smog problems in congested urban areas. Shortly, the environment for operating motor vehicles may become much more demanding. Demand for cars is now close to saturation in North America, Japan, and the western half of Europe. A small amount of incremental growth will be possible in the 1990s, but by the end of the century, producers in these markets will need to provide consumers with something new if they want to increase their sales volume, measured in dollars or marks or yen, rather than units. Moreover, the growth of vehicle use and increasing resistance to road building have made the road systems of these regions steadily more congested, gradually stripping motor vehicle use of its pleasure. New electronic vehicle technologies that permit vehicles to navigate around congestion and even, someday, to drive themselves might solve both problems. Handing driving over to the computer would permit car companies to charge more per car, even if they did not sell more units. And in-vehicle entertainment systems could be moneymakers as well, if drivers were relieved of the need to watch the road. Meanwhile, in the 1990s, cars and trucks that are able to gather information from the roadway about congestion and to find the fastest route to their destination could make much better use of limited highway space. Given the size of the potential prize, it's no surprise that governments and motor vehicle companies in North America, Western Europe, and Japan have recently initiated publicly funded cooperative research programs in each region to find technical solutions to these problems. However, making these technologies a reality is truly daunting. The computer industry is still a long way from adequate computing power for autopilots, and the reliability of such systems would have to be very high. Although motor vehicles under human control kill more than 100,000 people each year in North America, Western Europe, and Japan combined, it's hard to imagine that the public would accept a computer-controlled system that killed a half or even a tenth as many people. What's more, solutions will have to be sought far beyond the research labs of individual companies, both because publicly owned roads will be a key element in the necessary information systems, and because the standards selected may have a major bearing on the health of national motor industries. The recent debate over worldwide standards for high-definition television, in which governments in each major region have jockeyed to provide an advantage for their home team, are perhaps a foretaste of what is to come in the motor vehicle industry. A breakthrough in navigation and autopiloting could revitalize the consumer's desire to spend discretionary income on motor vehicles, even in the most saturated markets. However, even more startling breakthroughs in motor vehicle technology may be needed simply to preserve what society has already, if the worst predictions about the greenhouse effect are borne out. These focus on the potential effects of the rising levels of carbon dioxide, partly from motor vehicles, methane, and chlorofluorocarbons, partly from auto air conditioners, in the Earth's atmosphere. These emissions may dramatically raise temperatures and alter the global climate, if they're allowed to continue. In the worst case, early in the next century, we may see a dramatic rise in sea levels as the Antarctic ice melts, flooding much of the world's coastal plains where population is concentrated. We may also see rainfall patterns change to convert the world's breadbaskets to dust bowls. Even much more modest changes could threaten the Earth's ability to support its current population. Currently, the scientific debate on the greenhouse effect is extraordinarily confused. Everyone agrees that carbon dioxide, methane, and chlorofluorocarbon levels are rising, but the precise consequences of the increase are far from clear. Computer models incorporating the many feedback loops in the climate system are the keys to prediction. So far, however, the models are in only loose agreement and make their predictions only within a broad range. What's more, the fate of specific regions as climate changes is even less clear. On the other hand, society is now pouring enormous scientific resources into finding precise answers probably within the next few years. We would be surprised if the motor vehicle industry does not have to respond in dramatic ways, and its response may provide the final test of lean approaches to research and development. For example, in the extreme case, emissions of carbon dioxide might have to be eliminated altogether.